It has been so lovely to have a sister peace activist coming to speak tonight and also speaking for us to young college women because she's a special person. She's the director of the Trap Rock Peace Center over in Western Massachusetts. So Pat does many of the same kinds of things that we all work on here in terms of organizing local community efforts. But she does bring special expertise to it. Different, I think, from anyone except maybe Judith Enck. Pat is a retired environmental engineer, and she taught at Boston University's School of Public Health, where she brought a real feminist lens to working on urban environmental justice issues, from lead poisoning to urban agriculture to creating safe and decent housing for people. Pat has received multiple awards for her environmental justice work, and she's also authored 7 books on the subjects. She's also global. In 2014, she went to Vietnam to investigate the impact of Agent Orange, and she developed an environmental justice collaboration coming out of that called 10,000 Trees for Vietnam. In 2017, she went to Lebanon to interview Syrian women and children who had, you know, fled the war in Syria, with the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom on a project in Sierra Leone, which grew out of that organization's African Feminist Women's, a prolific writer. She now publishes and speaks widely on the effects of war and militarism on the society, and there are a number of her pieces over here on the literature table that you might want to pick up. Lucas is War and Warming, How Can We Save the Planet Without Taking on the Pentagon? After Pat's...
How happy I am that I said yes when I was asked to speak at your annual meeting. And the reason is, I have met a number of you briefly. We've talked. It's deeper than that. I am really, really impressed by the cohesiveness, the sense of community, the longevity of women against war. There's been studies about the superiority of collective intelligence over a few bright individuals, extremely bright individuals, that collective groups working together generally come up with better solutions when these have been studies that have been done. And this is what strikes me about Women Against War. You truly function as a deeply accomplished, successful, but collective, as opposed to some stars, even though you give awards to stars, I realize that, each year. But and it's something that, it's more visceral. I can feel it, in other words, is what I'm saying. It isn't just, it's nothing that I was prepared for, although I did look at your website, and they're pretty neat photos on there, and it just looked like really active, engaged women. And with a story, about 2.5 years ago, Connecticut 350.org, and you're familiar with 350.org. Believe it or not, I've met people who weren't. In fact, the woman at the union, at Times Union, who interviewed me, wasn't familiar with it. The woman called me and said that she wanted to have a conference in which she would invite 350.org, Connecticut, and also a venerable 50-year-old peace center from New Haven called Promoting Enduring Peace. I don't know if you've heard of them. So they came to the conference. I stand up to give this talk on war and warming, and I look out at the audience, and I realize that on my left, 350.org, the median age is 30. On my right, Promoting Enduring Peace, the median age is 70 to 75. And of course, I knew it intellectually, but to see it sort of bodily like that was quite striking. So I told the audience this. I said, if you could be up where I am and looked out, you would see that the generational difference with many peace activists, and that peace, war, and militarism and nuclear weapons are an agenda of an other era, is what it looked like, an earlier era, while progressive political energy is galvanized by climate change. So when I pointed this out, as I looked out to the audience, one climate activist, 30, 35, raised his hand, and he said that in his lifetime, no nuclear weapons had been used, while climate change had worsened. So I pointed out that in his lifetime, the United States has been involved in dozens of wars and conflicts. And further, our defense budget robs funds from renewable energy research and programs in the United States. And moreover, that the U.S. Department of Defense is the single greatest institutional contributor to climate change. But how would he know? The shrunken mainstream media. In 1983, there were 50 independent media companies. Today, there are 6. Furthermore, it carries less and less international news. Apparently, that dropped, the coverage of that dropped in the 80s and 90s to about 70%. And they avoid reporting on the immense loss of life and contamination of the environment in other countries that our wars have caused. I mean, remember watching TV during the Vietnam War, and never again. It was very clear that that influenced the public, turning some of them against the war. So with the media silence about our militarism and unquestioning bipartisan acceptance of our defense budget, how would he have known about the war-filled years of his young life? And is he aware, I wondered, of the impoverished budget for renewable energy versus that for defense? So as an example of the budget, between 2012 and 2015, the Obama administration invested $56 billion in clean energy internationally, here and internationally, while it, during that same period, committed $1 trillion for modernizing nuclear weapons, their infrastructure, and their delivery systems by 2030. And that doesn't include the Department of Defense budget. So renewable energy gets crumbs from the master's table, and not even those today with the Trump administration, and even more today with the Trump administration. You've probably seen this, but he has proposed in his budget an increase in defense funding for next year, $750 billion. You add the defense part of many other departments' budgets, and it goes over $1 trillion. At the same time, he has cut every other health, welfare, environmental agency, housing, education, Department of Labor, all of those have been cut. Environmental Protection Agency by 31%. That was the largest. And with the Department of Energy, it was cut 5%, but the cuts were very specific. It was into advanced research on renewable energy technology, solar and wind in particular, and also in energy efficiency in buildings. Thus, from my observation that day in Connecticut, I saw graphically that our movements largely work in silos, despite the actuality that war and fossil fuels have been fatally codependent since the Second World War. Oil is the lifeblood of our foreign policy. Thus, climate change, a consequence of fossil fuel dependency, is inextricably linked to our military policy. And here are a couple of examples. 1/4 to 1/2 of interstate wars since 1973 were linked to oil. Oil-producing countries are 50% more likely to have civil wars. Remember the 1980 Carter Doctrine during the oil crisis? we will use military force to defend access to Persian Gulf oil. So $8 trillion have been spent on naval patrols since the late 1970s, protecting oil cargoes in the Persian Gulf. The irony is those patrols are still there, but we are independent in terms of our fossil fuel reserves. So essentially, someone has pointed out that essentially our patrols are protecting the oil going to China. So oil is indispensable for war and the U.S. military superpower status, and oil is also at the center of the climate crisis. Obama's pivot to Asia had a central militaristic component, encouraging reopening new and previously closed military bases, both in Vietnam and also the Philippines. He was successful. And also war games with, quote, friends, Vietnam, Philippines, Japan, Australia, Thailand, etc. And naturally, selling more weapons to these countries. At the same time, Japan's essentially defunct peace constitution was also advocated and supported by the U.S. The key concern was and is a rising China. China is now the major threat to U.S. hegemony in Southeast Asia and the Pacific, according to the Pentagon, and also to our once dominant status in the world economy. I know you're familiar, if you're following this, that China is building bases on contested islands in the South China Sea. It has increased its military budget in tandem with ours. If ours goes up, theirs goes up. And so they are close to one-third that of the United States in terms of military budget. According to some security analysts, talk of fighting terrorism fills the media, but it is now secondary in the talk of U.S. and NATO generals, admirals, defense ministers. Many politicians of the West and NATO believe that war between great powers, Russia and China, but more so China, is not only possible, but may break out within 15 years. This is all documented in the defense news, which comes out every day. The first item is always readying for war with China. Therefore, Trump's pressure to raise spending for all the NATO countries, he wants 2% per country, 2% of their GDP. So he's pressuring, and a number of them are going along with it, and his pressure to both raise money and also to purchase our high-tech weapons, deploying more forces and more military joint exercises, all of this uses oil and exacerbates climate change emissions and heightens the potential for nuclear war, which of course is another form of climate change. According to the Pentagon News, the Pentagon plans on war with China in 15 years. I've read it in their news. And initially, they would say, because China is an economic threat to our national security. But our response is not to beef up economically, but it is to raise our defense budget. A Chinese journalist has written in response, "We are not your enemy, but if you decide we are, we must prepare without delay." And I do think that this is what's driving up their investments in their defense industry. I'd like to give you some specific data on what war costs in terms of fossil fuels and also the U.S. military. First, the U.S. war in Iraq. Over a period of 4 years, 2003 to 2007, the Iraq war generated more carbon dioxide equivalent in greenhouse gas emissions each year than 139 of the world's countries released annually. Second, and this is something most people, I haven't seen it written, but don't think and don't think about, when you destroy whole cities, as we have done in the Middle East, and also Saudi Arabia is doing to Yemen, and Syria has done to itself as well, but rebuilding Iraq, now Syrian and Yemeni, the schools, the homes, the businesses, the bridges, the roads, hospitals, pulverized by war, will require millions of tons of cement. Cement is the most fossil fuel intensive industry. And roughly 5% of our greenhouse emissions are attributed to the cement industry. So that's a kind of externality of war, which also makes war even more oil intensive. Another climate connection with conflict, and I know, and with war, you're familiar with this, but drought and the growing desert in Syria from climate change drove farmers to cities for survival, and this is in Syria, where they joined the popular uprising in 2011, and thus precipitating the Syrian government's war on its people. It is forecast that one of the factors of war in the future, particularly in the Middle East, possibly Africa as well, wherever there are severe climate impacts on agriculture, people's livelihood, that this will increase also conflict. After an unprecedented investigation into military use of fossil fuels, Bernie Sanders, author of a book called The Green Zone, calculates that the U.S. consumes as much as 1 million barrels of oil per day and contributes overall 5% of current global warming emissions. This is globally. It's not just for our country. Few whole countries use more oil than the Pentagon. Yet this comparison understates, as I see it, the extreme military impact on climate change. First of all, military fuel is more polluting because of the fuel type used for aviation. That's jet fuel. Carbon dioxide emissions from jet fuel are larger, possibly 3 times per gallon, than those of diesel and oil. Nor does this calculation include the fossil fuels used by civilian weapons makers. We are, of course, the largest weapons industry in the world. But they use oil for the manufacture of their weapons and also to test the weapons. So these greenhouse gases, they're using fossil fuel, also adds to the budget of war and warming. Also consider that many of the defense industry sites, as well as U.S. military bases, are Superfund sites in the sense that they have caused deep contamination. Some of that is leaking oil, some solvents, the use of firefighting foams most recently has been being studied. And also, just snatching a statistic out of 2008-2009 annual report of the President's Cancer Panel. So these change year to year, the number of Superfund sites and what they are. But in that year, nearly 900 of 1,300 Superfund sites were abandoned military bases or facilities, and manufacturing and testing sites. This is nuclear civilian manufacturing of weapons and testing sites that produce conventional weapons and other military-related products and services. So I just want to say that Superfund sites demand also an intensive fossil fuel use for the cleanup of those sites. So these are just, you know, there are these externalities, as I called them, that go along with our Pentagon budget, the part of the civilian defense industry, part of the contamination, part of the rebuilding of cement cities as a result of war. But what it makes clear is that environment, climate change, war, and militarism are so interlinked. And it makes it clear that we must work together in the climate and peace movement, because our issues they're married to each other. So some concluding observations. War mirrors the culture of a country. U.S. militarism, from its training, tactics, and logistics, to its reasons for going to war and its weapons of war, is distinctly shaped by the core elements of American identity. These determining cultural forces are, according to military historian Victor Hansen, Manifest Destiny, Frontier Mentality, Rugged Individualism, Unfettered Market Capitalism, and something that he calls Muscular Independence. Now, he's feting all of these. And proud of the sort of distinctive qualities that shape our country. And so these eminently masculinist qualities converge to generate bigger and more destructive war technology and the conviction that we need to be on top in terms of power projection, which Our power projection is primarily military. Every president says it and lauds it. Secretaries of State, Hillary Clinton did. So this is a bipartisan conviction and sense of pride in what we identify as a country. So the U.S. habit and competence for war, with its roots in the past annihilation of Native Americans, may be our society's nemesis unless we do critical soul-searching about our cultural and personal values and actively engage in transforming them. So let us remember and honor the plenitude of activist, nonviolent movements in our society that have profoundly challenged the dominant patriarchal profile of our culture as described by this military historian, Hansen. And these are, and I will run through, but it's not a completely inclusive list, but the women's movement for equality, against violence against women, the civil rights movement, immigrant and indigenous rights movements, the anti-war and peace movements, Black Lives Matter, and Standing Rock Water Protectors, progressive media, peace and justice studies, and progressive media, not just the studies of them, progressive labor and health worker unions like the California Nurses Union, the cooperative sustainable agriculture and transition town movements, and the pervasive climate change activism and victories against fracking and oil pipelines. The challenge is how to build voice, social cohesion, and public influence for our shared values and our activism, of a sense of the human community, our core connections as humans with nature, our empathy with the exploited, and our thirst for equality and justice. In these times of growing, and this is global, authoritarianism and corporate control, our hope for turning the tide will come from the local community-based campaigns and actions, as well as cleaning out the swamp of DC through free and fair elections. These local community-based campaigns and actions comprise anti-fracking ordinances, town by town, the fight for $15 minimum wage, city by city, churches and cities providing sanctuary for undocumented workers, children suing their government for their right to clean energy and a safe future, a livable future, as they were testifying before Congress today, I read. Campaigns against all forms of violence against girls and women, which have received such a shot in the arm in the past few years. Using community media to promote equal rights for all, supporting anti-racism education and campaigns, and electing people to local and national office who champion these issues and campaigns. And we've just, I hope, had the first taste of that with these last elections in 2018. It's very exciting to see these young radical women there. Que ça dure, may it last. Working together, we must turn the tide on these destructive forces and create an incoming tide of humanistic and nature protection campaigns. So put differently, we must live by the two golden rules. The first, love thy neighbor as thyself. It's a tradition, millennial, you know, a thousand years tradition by the mainstream great, what are called great religions. Some of us are not religious, so calling them great religions, you understand they are the monotheistic religions, etc., but also Buddhism. And but the second one, second golden rule, love thy nature as thyself. And this comes from indigenous traditions, of course. So these principles encompass the two defining issues of our times, those two golden rules, militarism and climate change. We must work together, not in silos, to reverse them and promote enduring peace on Earth and enduring peace with Earth. So I will finish. I'm sure a number of you really love Mary Oliver's poetry, and I see a lot of heads nodding. And so this is just taken. It's a stanza taken from a longer poem, and it goes like this. Oh, no. The path to heaven doesn't lie down in flat miles. It's in the imagination with which we perceive this world, and the gestures with which we honor it. I feel that Women Against War honors it with so many gestures, as I heard about everything that you have done this year. And I am wondering, and this is something that the Trap Rock Center is doing, if engaging in climate change activism, having a committee who will take that on, could, but then always, as you said, partnering, co-sponsoring with a climate change group might be the way to create a small bridge between the issues of peace, women against war, and climate change. But I will finish here, and I think if we have time, maybe a brief discussion about where do we take this in terms of the two issues actually so aligned with each other. How do we work in such a way that we work on them at the same time?